My name is Joe Barnt. This hour, during this week, at the lecture following and discussion series following coffee break, are going to be facilitated by myself and by Al Pitcher up in the balcony. When it's his turn, he'll come down from the balcony, I think. Myself, probably today and tomorrow, and Al and I together on Wednesday, and then on Thursday and Friday. Al, for those of you who are going to be around all week, I realize that a lot of people are going to be leaving tomorrow morning. And so you don't have to take part in all of them in order to hopefully have something beneficial from one of them or two of them. This morning I'd like to particularly address the subject of racism in the church and society in the United States, and perhaps get a little bit into the task of the church in urban settings. Maybe we'll get into that, maybe we won't, because I really want to use a style which doesn't have just the whole hour inputting from me. On most subjects we should have discussion on this one in particular, I think there should be plenty of time for people to say, you're full of it, or I agree with you, or what I think is, to share some of our experiences about the problem of dealing with racism in America. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I've spent most of my ministry involved in one form or another of civil rights or anti-racism work in the United States. Al Pitcher and his wife Sarah and I worked together once for some time in Chicago in the movement there when Dr. King was in Chicago for that phase of the civil rights movement in the 60s. Just a lot of experiences that you and I all have to share with each other. It's a little hard to think about doing that in 1 hour, but I'd like for us to try, at least to begin to share some of our sense of where we are in the struggle to combat racism in America, especially as Christians who celebrate by the communion railing every Sunday. We take the bread, we drink the wine, and are made one. And in making us one, deny and become a part of a whole body that resists the divisions by race or any other kinds of divisions in the world, and become one with all of those around the world who are struggling against those divisions to create wholeness in the world. So that's a kind of a starting point I come from. I think that there are at least three reasons why we need to keep talking about struggling with and dealing with racism. There are a lot of people, you know, who say we dealt with that last decade, that we took care of that. There are more important things now. And we have certainly different ways of looking at things now than we did in the 60s. But I think there's at least three reasons why we need to constantly try and keep before ourselves the question of dealing with racism in America and throughout the world. One is because, at least from my point of view, and I let me say from the beginning, my permission, if you need it, to disagree. We won't get anywhere in dealing with this subject or any other similarly controversial subjects if we sit back and say he's all wrong but don't say anything about it. But from my point of view, we didn't deal with that much in the 60s. A lot of things happened in the 60s, especially on personal levels. I think each of us on personal levels, many of us on personal levels, have learned to understand the nature of our personal racism and to overcome it. But in terms of the, and I'll say more about this in a few moments, but in terms of the systemic institutional racism that affects black people in the United States and brown people and red people and yellow people and many poor white people too in the United States, it still persists. The persistency of racism in the United States is to me seems to be at least as strong as it was in the 60s. And in many ways, like Reconstruction days in the early part of the century, is coming back. Racism is coming back in terms of people having permission to be racists. The second reason, besides the fact that I think that racism is very, very persistent amongst us, is that I think that all of us are in a stage of transition. Whether or not we're aware of it, many of us still live in white enclaves, or what I prefer to call white ghettos, in the suburbs, or don't have much contact with black people, brown people, red people, yellow people in the United States, and still live with a white consciousness of what controls and dominates their life, I think we're all in a stage of transition, and that either is happening already or will be happening to all of us, both in the terms of transitions taking place in the United States, whether we like it or not, but also in the world. In the context of the world's population, white people are a minority. The Western world is a minority. We've lived with the privilege of power and privilege in determining what happens in the rest of the world for a long time, and for centuries, and I believe that's coming to an end. I believe the time of our transition is upon us, and is very important about how we learn to respond to that, whether we, like Pharaoh say, I'll go all the way to the Red Sea before I'll let you go, and then find the waters crashing in over us, or whether we find some way to be in transition, to let go in a different creative kind of way. So besides the fact that racism is still persistent amongst us and that all of us are in a state of transition, I think there's a third reason for looking at racism, and that is because it's an illustration. It's an illustration of one amongst many systems in our society that are interlocking and interwoven and that desperately need to be changed. And not one of them gets changed alone. But and I'll say more about that in a few moments, but it's an illustration of just one system, and if we can learn from that, we can also learn about other systems that are need to be changed. For example, the systems that run our cities, or the economic system that run our lives, or the cultural value systems that we're taught, and so forth. And later on in the week, Al Pitcher will be dealing with that in a much more creative way than I could. Okay, that's just three reasons why, amongst many, I guess, that we really need to look at racism. Maybe a fourth one is just because each of us personally needs it in terms of being able to be free ourselves to live our lives more humanly. All right, the second thing I'd like to do besides saying that is that I'd like to, in order to get the discussion going, I'd like to give what I consider to be four principal characteristics of racism, definitions, if you will, understandings of racism. And I'll give them as briefly as I can, but as so that we can take some time for you to think through and say, yeah, that illustrates my understanding of it. I give illustrations, or I think that's wrong, and I have another point of view. So let me give four characteristics of racism in our society that I think we have to deal with, and then we'll go on from there. First of all, and maybe I should write these. No, I won't write them on the board. You can keep them in your mind. The first of all, that racism is a white problem, mainly. That racism is a white problem. We tend to think of it as racism is the victim's problem. You know, it's black people's problem. We've got to help black people change. But from my point of view, the problem of racism is our problem. Black people have problems as a result of racism, and red people and yellow people and brown people in our country and throughout the world. But the system which causes it is a white problem, our problem. It's our need to change. Let me give a couple of illustrations of what I mean by that, or a couple of further words about that. A definition of racism that I think is rather is good because it's both simple and as accurate as I can put it, is that racism is prejudice plus power. Now, everybody is prejudiced, especially in our society. Black people, brown people, red people, yellow people, white people, we're all prejudiced. We're all taught to be prejudiced. We're all taught truths and lies about each other that make us prejudiced towards each other and guard against each other and think nasty thoughts about each other. We're all prejudiced. But racism is prejudice plus power to enforce your prejudices. If you individually or collectively, we collectively, thought racist things or prejudiced things about people of other races and had no power to affect those people with those prejudices, I would say by my definition that's not racism in the sense that it doesn't have the power to enforce it. Black people, brown people, red people, in our society and principally throughout the world don't have the power in terms of large systems to enforce prejudice. And therefore, I, for my definition at least, there is no such thing in our country, or practically no such thing in our country, as black racism, or red racism, or brown racism. But the principal problem in our country is white racism, our racism. And I'll come back to that. You can disagree with that. But I want to say a few more these other characteristics, because I think they blend in, and then you can and then you can come back at that. So the first thing is that it's a white problem, and that in terms of racism, it's white people and white systems that need to change, not black people and black systems that need to change. They need to change as a result of our racism. And that means that we cannot blame the victim, as is often happens. Secondly, I don't want to just say racism is a white problem without quickly saying right after that is that racism is also a white prison. When I say, you're a racist, you know, if I said that, you know, and I didn't say anything else more than that, I'd heap you up with guilt. I'd make you responsible. It's all your fault, and you are in charge of your life, and you'd better change or you're going to get it. You know, get wiped out. But I'd really like to say is that in a system of racism, if you're black and I'm white and I'm part of a system that oppresses you, you are imprisoned by the system of racism, but so am I. I do not want to be a racist. I'm sure that you do not want to be a racist. And when I say we are racist people and we want to change and that we need to change, that does not mean some kind of an accusation that says you want to be racist. I think none of us want to be racist. I think that for the most part, racists are made and not born. That is that all of us are may have the tendency in that brokenness that all of us suffer from birth on, to hate and to oppose and divide each other, but the be caught in a system, you're in that system whether you want to be or not. Now, if anybody should be in the room, and I doubt it very much, that wants to be a racist, then the place to start with that is dealing with the fact that that is a sin and needs to be repented of and needs to be forgiven and needs to be dealt with on whatever level that you want to be a racist. But I don't think that's the principal problem of any of us. I think the problem is that if I'm a racist and you suffer from my racism, then both of us are in a prison. If you could just illustrate that, if I had a gun on you and could to control your life, one of the prisons I'm in is that I could never put down that gun. I'm totally controlled by that kind of thing. But even more importantly, that excuse me, let's get in the chair. More importantly, that when we talk about black people being in a ghetto, therefore prison, you can't talk about black people being in prison in a ghetto without talking about white people being also separated and segregated off in our own ghettos. If you talk about black people, brown people, red people being culturally deprived, and when we say they are culturally deprived, we mean because they ain't got ours. We have to be able to understand that we are culturally deprived because in that imprisoned situation, we ain't got theirs. And the richness of sharing people, sharing cultures, sharing values, sharing traditions, and the being of cut off from one another in a divided kind of way, there is no such thing of one person being in a prison without the other person also being seen as in a prison. Martin Luther King and many, many great people before him said that when the black person gets free from the results of racism, it will be through that process that the white person gains freedom also. You put it in the same level too in terms of sexism as another system of oppression in our country. People tend to talk about even if they favor women's liberation, about women needing to be free. Most of us men, I think, are going to, I hope most of us, at least many of us, are going through the process of discovering, through the process of women becoming free of male oppression, males are also becoming free to learn again what it means to be human and not to be caught up by the need to be dominant. When black people get free from racism, white people are getting free at the same time. Just one other thing about that white prison and about guilt. I've had a lot of interesting time over the years in doing a lot of anti-racism training and working with people in racism and about the problem of guilt. The first time in 1965, 66, the first time I ever conducted a seminar on racism, and I didn't know how to conduct a seminar on racism. I was really playing it by ear. I had no idea. So I got through. The people who had to go through all my stuff, I asked them, how did I do? And they said, you made us feel guilty. And they were very angry because I made them feel guilty. And so I started feeling guilty because I was making people feel guilty. And so then I went through the process of trying to construct seminars on racism that didn't make people feel guilty. And I found out that it was just impossible. And I think I've come to the conclusion that that's not the Christian understanding of how to deal with racism and guilt. But that from the Christian point of view, the way of understanding guilt is not to deny it and say, let's keep it out of the room, but rather to say, let's put it right up front. And when you put it up front, you've got it up on an altar, and you put on the altar guilt and repentance. And if Christians don't know what to do with guilt, then who does? By the authority that is invested in me, by Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, I forgive you of all of your sins. And now you are free to work against racism. Now you're free not to live by guilt. You're even free to be angry at the systems that make you into a racist and to combat against them, arm in arm with black people, to combat racism in our society. All right, that's enough to say. It's a white problem, first. Second, it's a white prison. It's we, not just black people, who are in need of the liberation that Jesus Christ comes to offer us, and the liberation to live a new life in our society. Thirdly, you have to divide racism into two camps, two types of racism. And I already did talk about this in the very beginning, but I want to say it in a little bit more detailed way. Personal racism and institutional racism. You can go around just being a personal racist, and have all those attitudes and understandings and the way you act and the way you think and the way you talk, which reflect whether or not you have dealt with your racism or not. For the most part, while that's very important to deal with, and I think a lot of us have been dealing with it, that's not what does the damage. But rather it's institutions in a society that maintain a white dominant society over a predominantly white over a predominantly black society. My home is in the South Bronx, which is said to be one of the worst black ghettos in the United States. Nobody in that community goes around thinking of personal racism as being the cause for the conditions of that community, but rather the systems that created that community and are now destroying that community have to do with the systems of banks and real estate agents and police systems and criminal law, criminal justice systems and economic systems of employment and education. All of those systems combine to create, among other things, an oppressive situation for the majority of black people in our country. They also systemically create personal racists. The racism that you grew up with and learned was systematically, institutionally put inside of you. All right, that's the third thing. When we get to discussion, I'd like us to spend some time talking about what systems. Let me just give one other illustration. If Haiti is a black person and there is a clamp around my wrist, and make that clamp into the banks, the employment situation, education, whatever it is. There's a clamp around my wrist so that I participate in a machine that keeps pounding her in the face. You know, which of us is institutionally imprisoned? And the answer is both of us. I do not accept responsibility on a guilt level, especially if I'm also working with a saw trying to get that clamp off my hand, along with other people, for the damage that's doing to Haiti. But rather, I seek ways in which both of us try and combat the machine that is destroying both of our lives. Okay, one other point. First of all, that it's a white problem. Second, that it's a white prison. Third, that there's personal and institutional racism, and it's institutional that does the primary damage. And fourth, that racism doesn't stand alone as simple an evil that's separate and unconnected with other injustices in our society. But rather, I'd like to see us learn to think of racism as being an interconnectedness with, for example, the systems of that affect all of us and oppress all of us, like the arms race and the economic system that's also affecting us because it's escalating in terms of increased costs of living, and that is hurting all of us. That interconnected with the with racism and sexism and classism that divides us all from each other, and nationalism. Let me give an illustration of that. In that, it's an illustration of the conflict I've faced in terms of doing desegregation work in factories. One time, I helped to desegregate a napalm factory. Dick Gregory used to describe the south side of Chicago, the area of Hyde Park and South Kenwood, as that place if some of you don't know that, it's an upper, more or less an upper class black and white integrated or desegregated community. And he said it's that community where black and white stand together hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder against the poor. the symbol of desegregating a napalm factory for me suggests the image of black people and white people standing together hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder, bombing the hell out of Vietnam. So that just getting black people into parts of our system which need to be changed isn't changing racism, but helping black people to be participants, to get the clamp around their head, around their wrists with us. And so that they'll stop complaining and be able to make money at pounding fists at somebody else. Now, napalm factory, and I must confess, not with much guilt, because I got that all forgiven, but that I did help to desegregate an arms factory once, but that's not just the problem, not just a factory you can identify and say, there, they make napalm, or they make atom bombs, but rather any institution in our society, and that includes schools, also includes the church, if it does it, any institution in our society which perpetuates and helps to support a system that manufactures and can use napalm on other populations, participates in being a napalm factory. So it's not all that, you can't just separate all the guilt over there and say, but rather that all of us somehow are struggling against a collection of systems that don't just imprison poor people throughout the world, but that are also threatening our own very way of being, because we're using it up on stupid things, and we're hurting a lot of people while we're doing it, including ourselves, in terms of ensuring the future of our own society to be a place to be free and at peace. Okay, that's all I got to say. As a way of introduction, I've got some other things, if we have time, to talk about in terms of ministry and urban setting, so forth. But let me stop there and see what kind of response I've brought up in you. Say anything you want, talk about anything you like to, in terms of those points, whether you agree, don't agree, illustrating them. There's a hand over here.
Haven't you broadened the definition of racism to such a an all-encompassing subject that it's almost impossible to deal with. Once you take it out of the individual racism, the prejudice, if you take prejudice plus power, and then take away the individual racism and talk about institutional racism, aren't you now talking about the entire economic system, the entire ethical system, the entire a much bigger subject than would require a narrower top name such as racism?
Yeah.
And doesn't that make it difficult to deal with?
I think, let me try and respond to that. One time, that would, although I was very defensive about it, that probably would have been a very valid accusation of me. I think one time I was so and consumed by my involvement in race issues that probably I saw the whole world's evil resting on a foundation of racism. I think that what I just attempted to say did not say that, especially that last point to say that racism is interconnected with a lot of other systems of injustice and involved, cannot be separated out of, and therefore is hooked up with a lot of other large oppressive systems. But I think I'd like to leave the definition of racism, not keep it so narrow as to be personal. That's just personal racism. That's a cop-out, because the people that I live with and live amongst in the South Bronx are hardly hurt by personal racism. It's the institutions that keep them where they are. But I'd like to limit to talking about racism as that function of interrelated oppressive injustices that we are imprisoned in ourselves, that result in the systematic oppression of black people because of prejudice plus power. I think that's not so, but I'd like to be opening to learn more about that if that's so. There's hands all over the place. Back there?
I don't feel like there's a difference, and maybe you would agree with me, between personal racism and institutional racism, because it's personal racism that pays the taxes to keep the institutional racism going. And I feel like it's only going to change when the hearts of mankind change, then the institutions change, but they're no more than part of us.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I didn't mean to keep them so separate that they're not connected. Our personal, you know, we participate in those systems on a personal level also. Yep. You can't blame it just simply on an impersonal system. We all participate in that. Yeah.
You're talking about institutional racism and stuff. What if there is a solution? Do you think there is the way of going about it? Is it you're going to have to teach kids when they're younger or something in schools or prevent them from being the next generation of the institutionalized racists?
I don't want to dodge that question, but I'd like to have, before going on to a whole new area of, you know, how do we fight this, let's have some more, let's try and talk some about that. But let's have some more reactions and where you're at in terms of what's been said so far.
Are you of the opinion that through tinkering with institutions or whatever you want to do, that you'll ultimately remove the injustices or something from earthly life?
I don't know what you mean by tinkering.
Well, you know, you're talking about removing or changing institutions that cause injustice. Or do you feel that can ultimately be taken care of or solved?
Are you asking whether I think we can create heaven on earth?
That's right.
Well, I think that God's in charge in creating heaven, in heaven and on earth, is bringing his kingdom. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Do you mean that if I can't promise you heaven, you won't participate in the struggle to come to improve the institution?
Whether you think that ultimately you can take sin out of the world.
God's in charge of that.
Well, I think he's
in terms of, but he's put us in charge of fighting, struggling for justice and mercy in our world.
Yeah, I appreciate that. What I'm trying to get at is where you think the goal can be, because people in the past who have felt that you can totally remove injustice from the world have ended up killing people, like in the French Revolution, and in, you could say, Soviet Union at different times.
Or in the United States.
For example. No, I'm asking you for an example.
Civil War. Revolutionary War.
Were they trying to
the number of people we executed over the last two centuries. John Brown's raid. The number of people that were killed by the police in Philadelphia over the last 10 years for racial reasons, or any other city. I just picked that out because I hated their police chief at the time. We do horrible things to each other.
Yeah, and often that's as a result of what your goal is.
No, I think the horrible things we do are a result of the oppression in the first place. I'm sorry, we're not communicating very well. You're trying to make a point, and I don't think I understand it.
Okay. The point I'm trying to make is one of the real problems with, say, for example, communism is that you have this dialectical materialism where you go through one stage or another, and the ultimate goal is more important than the people who are living through the various stages. And it turns out that the people can be expendable to get to the ultimate goal. And I'm trying to find out how you feel. Do you feel that you can create a heaven on earth, which has led some of these people to make the people in the interim be expendable?
I believe that one of the problems of our systems is they only often get caught in the trap of just what you described, of making people expendable in order to achieve their ultimate goal, and that is of making us comfortable. That the expendable people have been, among others, black people, brown people, red people, yellow people in our society. So it is precisely that philosophy of making people expendable in order to achieve some other goal that needs to be combated in our institutions. And of institutions which give privilege to one over another and therefore make them expendable. I don't think we're going to perfect ourselves in this world. I think we're in charge of our institutions, and I think that the institutions live for us, not us for the institutions. And I think that when institutions hurt others, they ultimately are going to be hurting us, and that we, especially who have placed ourselves at the foot of a cross, are responsible for combating injustice and working for institutions that produce justice in our society. Knowing that that's part of a process in which the kingdom of God, in which I'm living out my celebration of the fact that the kingdom of God is in fact coming, in which all things shall be made new, ultimately, not by me, but that my efforts are a celebration of that. I think you already did talk. Let me let some others have a chance to talk, and let me not try and respond so much to your questions, but just to hear what some of your opinions are. So let's get three in a row. One, two, and three.
The church as a large institution in the United States, do you think it's taking a stand on racism as a whole?
Well, you've asked a question. I said I wasn't going to respond. Do you think that it's taking a stand on
racism? I don't think the church as a whole is making a stand on racism. I think maybe individuals within the church are attempting to do that, but the church as an institution has not come up with one basic plan against racism. No.
Let's hear a few more things. We'll come back to some more on that.
I just want to understand what Eric was saying. I hear you saying that, so in understanding our goal, we have to realize that we cannot probably completely accomplish it.
Yeah, that's all I'm trying to say.
Could you repeat what you said, he said?
That it will continue to be a struggle. And that it will not be, we can't wrap it up neatly and put it away on the shelf and go on to another goal.
Yeah.
But that's part of the goal.
The only problem I'm trying to bring out is that if you think that you can accomplish or make things perfect, you're making yourself into a god. And you're setting yourself above the people you're trying to work with or help.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think history shows us, usually ends up in people getting killed.
Okay. All right. I want to confess that part of my strong reaction to you, at least internally, I don't know if I showed it, is the fact that you went and raised the communists as being wrong. We're not dealing with a problem that the communists caused or the communists are dealing with, but rather, the contrast and the analysis of the problem, I wanted to keep within the context of blaming us, of seeing our problem and our inconsistencies in dealing with it. I don't think the inconsistencies, and there are many of the communists, have influenced this problem.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I just need that.
Okay, all right, thank you. And thank you for clarifying.
Right. You and I are probably the only ones who have ever been to the South Bronx, because that's where I was born. And I'm rather amazed, because I moved from there as a very young child, but I'm rather amazed when you say that the people in the South Bronx don't feel that, because I feel that racism, to a great extent too, is a class problem, because the rich black guy hasn't the slightest interest in what's happening to the poor black guy at all. And the rich white person, I mean in a class, never has to be confronted with the black problem because his children go to private school, etc. But I, who have moved away, still have some family, not in the South Bronx, but in New York. And I too, theoretically, since I am much against racism, would say, oh, now it can't be that bad, and oh, come on now, you know, where's your Christian spirit? And one day, about 3 years ago, my brother took me for a drive to the South Bronx where we used to live, and I was absolutely horrified. It absolutely looks like the aftermath of a war.
Looks like Dresden after the fire.
It burned down buildings. I burst into tears. I said, where's the house that we used to live in? He said, you see that burnt out parking lot with old rubber tires, and it's just a bunch of rubble everywhere. Now, who is the one who suffers with this? It's the poor or the lower middle class white person who moved out of that house, or that house was burned down and had to move someplace else. And I remember as a child, these were poor immigrants that lived there. They lived in these, tenement houses. They were poor. And I use the word underprivileged. I don't agree with the word underprivileged. I think if you have lots of love, sometimes I never know I was underprivileged. You know, I mean, I had four sisters older than I, and I never had a new dress, but I never felt underprivileged. However, the point I want to make is there has to be a certain hatred among that lower white class person whose house has been burned down, that little storekeeper. I mean, I'm talking about the little mom and pop store. I mean, they don't touch, and God forbid they do, Macy's or any one of these big places. They get the little guy who's just about eking out a little tiny living for he and his family. That's the store that these blacks and Puerto Ricans burn down in their hostility against this terrible system. So, I mean, I could understand how this white person could feel, all those blacks and those Puerto Ricans, they ought to just send them all away. Look what they've done to our neighborhood. You know, it's very easy in the Northwest to sit back and theorize about all this because they are not confronted with a black problem to any great extent. They really don't have it, really. They may have an occasional black person come to their church and everybody looks over, oh, who's that?
You just raised a lot of issues.
I'm just saying. I'm acting almost as like a devil's advocate, you see.
One of the things,
and I don't agree with you about the fact that the people in the South Bronx, perhaps in a theological world, they say, oh yes, because they are for they're against racism. But you speak to that mother who's now being bused far, far away from school. She's not happy. She never maybe didn't feel badly about black people, but she does now.
Did I give some impressions that she was?
No, but you said in the South Bronx they don't feel.
Well, if you'd hold it for a second, I'd like to say I think you misunderstood me.
Because
I didn't say that. I said that black people, you know, sure, there's just as much prejudice as well as hostility, more so that towards the people, individuals, that's expressible in black people than from white people. I said black people understand that the principal cause of their problems are by systems, because they suffer from those systems, and not affected by just simply individual hatred for them. But they understand. They Yeah, interesting. I think, by the way, your comment about underprivilege is very important too. The opposite of underprivileged, we don't like to apply, it's overprivileged. The opposite of underdeveloped is overdeveloped. And we've got to really face those facts.
I find it hard for you to say that black racism doesn't exist, because I have one black friend who he admits himself that he's a black racist. To him, white is ugly, black is beautiful. And you can say this comes about somewhat because of white oppression, but has reached a point that he's totally alienated from anything white. He doesn't like the church because it's mainly white Protestant. And as far as hurting, you say that they can't hurt other white people. He does everything he can to do that. I think you'd get a different opinion from some of the higher up supervisors in the company where he works about whether he hurts them, because he's been considered such a troublemaker that they have in his personnel file, don't mess with this guy, the government will be upon your back. And I see things like quotas, you know, that force black, you know, take black people and put them in, and I see these not acting out of love, but out of a rigid legalism. I try to eliminate as much prejudice from my life as I can, but I see these things in a way, my hackles are up as a reaction to it. So my feeling is that there is indeed racism on the other side. And I agree with what she's saying, a lot of our problems in the U.S. are not so much prejudice against the blackness of the guy's kin, but a class prejudice, and beyond that, a prejudice. Well, when I was young, I thought I had no prejudice against the black people, and I found out it was wrong. I'd accept a black person if he was a Protestant, if he was, you know, if he was white, not because of his skin, but in his background. I was unwilling to accept his ethnic background. And it's more than just prejudice against color of the skin, is what I'm saying. It's oftentimes a class prejudice and an ethnic prejudice.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I said that. I think I said something about the interconnectedness of racism and classism and sexism and nationalism, so that they affect and really get mixed up. And it's important to separate them out, to look at them, and it's important to see them in their interrelatedness and very confusing complexity. I also need to say that I did say that use my definition of racism as prejudice plus power, and said there's lots of prejudice on both sides. And you just said I'm wrong, or you just said there's lots of prejudice on both sides, and I agree with you. I did not call that racism, because the power that runs the system, the class race system, takes it out, has the power to enforce the prejudices against black people. More.
I'm not too sure if I can verbalize my thinking, but I think that we are really, we have to tie more closely together prejudice and racism than what you have done. Right here in this village in the last 3 days, I got into conversations with two or three small groups concerning the Indians and the fish issue. Now, there's no prejudice, not a bit. But nobody likes those red-ass bees that's getting all the fish. They are stupid and illiterate. And now, this isn't racism, and this isn't prejudice. I have no prejudice against an Indian, but I have a real strong feeling against people who are illiterate and who don't think the same way as I do.
Why are they illiterate? What choice?
There it is. Take off from there. That's their fault.
Yeah, I want to make sure I clarify. You're saying what you've heard people say or what you believe?
I think it's a mixture of both. Mm-hmm. I think that each and every one of us can easily put this problem out into the ghetto. We can put it out someplace else. But each and every one of us are carrying this racism right with us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we will overlook. This Indian issue is not a part of what you are talking about. I mean, we can sweep that under the rug real easy and say, hey, that's got nothing to do with it. Because this is a different problem. But this is just as much racism and prejudice. But it's here at home, and we won't face it.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, the fishermen are losing half their income, too. And that's an important thing for them.
You bet it is. And so is these people in South Africa. If we don't get money into the oil companies. It's really an important thing to them, but people die. People out here on the reservation are going hungry. This is close to home, and this is really hard for us to accept. This is one that's pertinent to us here.
Thank you.
It's close enough to what we talk about. It's easy to sit and talk about South Africa. That's way off down there.
Or the South Bronx.
That's right.
Yeah. And I wanted to say that after you had said about the no black problem here, I've really been hearing a lot also this last 2 weeks being here at Holden Village from Washingtonians and neighboring states about the so-called Indian problem.
Indian. It's really easy for me to bring this up because I'm from Idaho.
Right. The Indian problem, the black problem, the Chicano problem, even the way we say it, you know, makes it their problem, or our problem we're having with them, rather than our problem and the problem they're having with us.
Doesn't this idea, there where I'm talking somewhat about quotas, doesn't the idea of saying to the Indians, well, you've got the right to have the fish, isn't that sort of a form of prejudice of saying, well, we understand you can't get out there with a net and catch as many fish as we can, so we'll deliberately give you this, and you'll never be as good as we are, but we'll just give it to you, you know. Isn't that, quotas to me smack of the idea of saying to the guy, well, you just aren't as good as I am, you can't compete in the world, so I'm going to just give it to you, and to me that's sort of a form of prejudice.
I don't know much about the Indian problem up here. I cannot speak to that. I can express some feelings I have about quotas and busing and all those things, all of which I despise as being awful, awful things to do, but absolutely necessary in terms of where we are. I'll just leave it at that. I don't, as we go piecemeal into attempting to deal with those problems, and adjusting and being forced to adjust every step of the way, we're backing ourselves into a discovery about how much we are also imprisoned by our own system that once just hurt, the feeling of hurt was just once felt by black people, and the more it comes creeping up against our privileges and our own ways of life and our own livings, like the fishing, we'll find out how much those systems are imprisoning all of us and need to be really looked at in a different kind of way. But quotas and busing and things like that really do hurt. But I really also think they're necessary because of the way we've approached the problem.
I've only been here a few days, and I appreciate very much the leadership that you people are giving. And the participation too. But I have missed something. I don't know whether I am overly Bible-centered or whether we lose ourselves in human philosophy, but I feel a lack of direction from God Himself through His Word in these issues. And then I haven't heard anybody say, for instance, that St. Paul says, there's no Jew or Greek, no male or female. We're all one in Christ. Now, if this really becomes a part of our life, it's going to take care of a lot of racism and other problems that we are wrestling with and really don't have the inner direction to overcome or to face honestly.
Like to say, if you had been in my spot working with black contractors in Chicago, where there weren't any black people in any of the steel construction industry, there's about 1% black journeymen in all of the building trades in an area where the population is at least 20% black. And then you take the words from St. Paul, and what do you do? So what do you do? Now, if you started to introduce you know, trainees into the building trade, what percentage would you have to introduce into the building trade to eventually get a kind of just, equal participation in the building trade? If you start with 1%, you're 20% of the population. You know, and you got a roughly a 40-year cycle. You know, you have to take 100% for several years of blacks in order to get a kind of treatment of people is equal. It's very, very difficult. The last I knew, they were taking 6% in their trainees. But that would never, you see, it would never get you back into an equal situation. Once you have systematically excluded people from an industry, how do you get justice? Because people who could participate have been denied for years. Other people have those jobs. You know, the whole system operates to exclude black people from the building trade. Very lucrative trades, as you all know. Man, the money that comes. And the people who are in there, you know, don't need much more than 6th, 7th grade education in order to do most of the things that require. You know what's happening now, most of the things, prefabricated plumbing, all that stuff. What do you do?
Okay, we had two hands there and there. Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to say one thing that I think there seems to be almost like two parts here, you know, where you have what this man was saying over here, we need to deal with ourselves honestly and read our Bible and understand what God has to say to us about this thing. And not for one on the one hand just jump on a band-aid, which I've seen in myself, you know, coming from a small Midwestern community with no black people, the ones that no Indian people, no Chinese people, nothing. And going to a small college where we had a few black students and seeing people just falling all over themselves trying not to be prejudiced. And we really weren't dealing with ourselves honestly about, you know, our prejudices that we have. And I think this maybe is part of what has happened a little bit in our government, in our institutions, with respect to what you were talking about. Well, we have to give them so many things now, you know, and that really doesn't help with the integrity. And also agreeing with what you were saying about, it seems like I think all of us who have a profession or especially meeting others, you know, every kind of profession, know that when you first start for many years or many months, it's just confusing. There's no system to it. And I think it's the same with trying to bring it equal, you know, to many people. You know, maybe what we're doing, certain things are bad, and, you know, but like you said, we have to have something for certain things. At least that's why we don't always agree with it, but we have to have it for a certain working through process.
So long as we live with an image that they are the ones in a prison or unfree, and we are the ones who are free, all of those things won't make sense to us. I think when we live, and it's only the kind of image we got from this man and straight from the Bible and St. Paul that sees all of us imprisoned and broken and becoming free, that those things begin to make sense to us, that those kinds of painful processes of taking both black people and us out of the prisons that we've created. I think I need to say that I'm grateful for anybody who quotes the vision of St. Paul, or the vision of Christ, or the vision of the creator of our heavens and our earth for wholeness, and to recall us back. I want to also respond a little defensively, sir, that I think that that the whole construct of both of the morning of being in Bible study, and I think of what I said in the beginning about our being the forgiven people of God in who've become the body of Christ, you know, put us, I hope, into that framework. And I just thank you for reminding us of again that it's because Christ has made us who we are that we've become free to struggle and combat against the racism in our society and to face it honestly and face our own selves honestly, as you mentioned. And and to look at the unions and the and see how unfulfilling of that image they are, and how Christ calls us into combat and work for those, for that kind of wholeness in our lives.
Well, I think I'm a pragmatist, and I respond to your institution idea. I interviewed a Gallup poll, and often the question will be, if blacks moved into your neighborhood, if blacks did this, what would your response be? And I always get unprejudiced answers. I mean, I always get, oh, that would be fine, we could stay here, and we would try to sell our property. Mm-hmm. But I think they're hiding behind their institutions. And that they know their institutions are going to protect them. They don't really have to worry about putting it on the line as a person. They're not living in the South Front. And until you're faced with putting it on the line as a person, it's kind of easy to say, well, I do it this way.
You know, we're starting to do second year in Seattle. And it's amazing how fast our parochial schools are filling up, mm-hmm. and how many people are moving to the suburbs. We don't, it's not because we don't want to bus our children, but, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. it's amazing how fast the last 6 months has been happening.
You know, I think we need to be in touch with how we are manipulated ourselves by those same systems that manipulate black people, and it's probably one of the places where many of us have experienced it the most is the way, is the manipulation by banks and real estate agents and the changing of communities. You know, whether it was South Bronx 25 years ago, that used to be an all-white, practically all-German community, and is now black and Puerto Rican and creeping up north, or whether it's Washington, D.C., and many of our central city areas, which have now gone through the process of people making money off of the sufferings of people until those communities were totally destroyed. Excuse me, and now white people moving and rich people moving back in again, and the slums expanding outwards, and each step of the way, millions of dollars being made at our expense and at the expense of black people, both of whom suffer in that process. Taking advantage of our fear and of our racism and of our unwillingness to, and our inability as individuals to stand up against that kind of onslaught. And we need to begin to be in touch, I think, with the fact that that those systems don't always just simply work for us. They make it look that way. But the people who sell their house for half of what it's worth, or in order to, because of their own fear and think they got to get their money out now, are suffering just as much as the people who are going to live in the slum that's created by that process.
I've been grappling, you know, through the hour with feeling the frustration, and I've felt this before, because I have a very sensitive feeling toward this in myself and in the church, and every time I come to grips with it, I sense always this feeling of frustration. I don't think it's ever going to leave me, because I am crucified with Christ, and I think the church will have to come to grips with the fact that we're always going to feel frustrated. But there was a statement, I think it was a program for the Luther League or something, and of course it was supposed to shock, but it was supposed to also have a meaning, and the program's heading was, "Who in hell wants to be a servant?" And I think that's what we're really grappling with when we talk about, you know, wanting to get rid of institutions that are, oppressive. Is, do I want to be a servant with my Lord as he was when he died on the cross to crush the power of the devil? And do I want to then put my life on the line and stand up, you know, and be Christ-like? And of course, you know, my old man is always with me, and it keeps wanting to come forth and not be a servant, and not to grapple with these problems. And that's just the statement I want to say. I'll probably always be frustrated, but I'll always be pulled by the power of the Holy Spirit to step into the gaps that are needing to be filled.
Thank you. I'd like to build on that too and talk about another level of always being frustrated. It goes back to something I said I'd comment on from the woman in the back who asked about the church and its own imprisoned in racism. And I, what you're looking at right here in this room is a white ghetto. And to say, how can we stop being racist? That is, how can we get rid of this problem and move on? And in a race, class, ghetto. Now, that's the nature of the place where we celebrate ourselves as the living body of Christ. we learn to live as free people in a ghetto, free people in a prison, who are being freed inside the prison, while we're inside the prison, in order to attack the walls of the prison. And we in the church don't just simply have a ministry to the world, but a ministry to the church and to our own selves about our own prison. And one could go on and talk for a whole session just about the way in which racism is expressed in the church and way in which there are the battle of combating racism within the church. Extremely important task. So it builds on that same thing, that frustration, that holy frustration of people who have become the body of Christ to struggle against the brokenness in the world and in our own church is what we've been freed to be, I think.
And the willingness to keep our face like Jesus, you know, set toward Jerusalem, set toward becoming a servant.
I think you're asking an awful lot of the churches. They've all gotten germs in our regions together.
Well, that's good that we haven't done it, I guess, because to be satisfied, if we'd done that and been satisfied, we'd really be in trouble. Because that's not a very holy place to be. That's still a ghetto.
may I share with you an experience in our congregation? We had a number of Negro families in our area. In one of the families, the parents were quite well educated. They sent their children to our Sunday school, and no one seemed to notice that they were black, for some reason or other. The congregation with a very strong German background. These children went to Sunday school. They served as acolytes, and the story went around. St. Paul Church is the only church or the first church in Portland that ever had an acolyte, a black acolyte. Now, these people were just simply received. But when we, and they came to confirmation class, now whether they finished or not, I don't know. But when we approached the parents for integration and membership, they said, it's very difficult for us because we do not want to become a show window. They felt that it would be almost impossible for us to treat them as just another person and not a black person. So that's another problem that they have, and I suppose we have too.
Kids are really beautiful. They don't even most of the time know the difference. My daughter was telling me about her little 4-year-old boy, and somebody pointed out to him that a certain girl was black, and he didn't even know what that meant, you know, a black person. So that was another thing he learned, and he just kept prodding on it all the time. And finally my daughter told him it's not the thing to do. So I was in the park with him, and there was a black girl sitting there, and he said, look at that black girl. And I said, now don't do that, and because I didn't want the girl to be hurt. And we walked along, and then there was somebody standing there with a black poodle. And he said to me, what color is that dog? And I said, black. And he said, how come you could say black about the dog and you wouldn't let me say black about the girl? And you know, I didn't know what to answer. And I said, you just do it because I said so. Because the fish was so intelligent, I was so stupid, I didn't know how to answer. So this is where it all begins. You know, this is where they learn. It's such an important, it was such an important answer for me to give him at that moment of his life. And I couldn't think of anything intelligent. So I just wanted to answer that about the kids. The kids really don't really know the difference, actually. It's the adults, unfortunately, they get to learn it as the world pushes them around a bit.
Yeah, we have to close, and I we can go so many directions with these discussions, and that maybe one of the ways of closing is to say that I, and maybe just a minor point, but some people feel that the answer to race problems is to become colorblind. I do not believe that. I believe look at that black girl, she's a black girl. Look at that white girl, she's a white girl. I believe that that when you're in a prison, the way of dealing with that prison is not to pretend you're not in a prison, or to put up fancy curtains and make it look like that we have, that our racial, cultural traditions and values and languages are very beautiful things to share, and that we have been so deprived because we have not been able to, we have been in a prison, that we cannot learn the richness of black and red and brown and yellow traditions in our country and throughout the world, and have a lot of them as part of our traditions. And so I believe in color consciousness for that reason, as well as to become conscious of the systems and the way they oppress people. So both the beauty and the ugly in our racial differences need to become conscious of and not colorblind to. Not because black people need our help, not because Native American people need our help, not because Asian and Mexican American and Puerto Rican people need our help, but rather because we need theirs. Because our own freedom to be human beings depends upon our struggling against racism. There's a way of living that St. Paul talked about in being no Jew, Greek, and so forth. That means that that when we are divided from our brothers and sisters in the world along racial, sexual, national, class lines, and when systems of hostility are built up against them, even if we end up being the ones on top, and they the ones in the bottom, you've just described two kinds of non-human beings, or two ways not to be a human being. And only in struggling against them do we and they become human again. So I really advocate class consciousness, race consciousness, sexism and sex consciousness in a way for us to lift up both the beauty of our differences and the dividedness of systems that use those differences to oppress one another and put us in prison. I'm open to talk more if anybody wants to, but it's time to stop.